Betsy?
Hi, Rachel. Can you hear me?
I can. Let me make sure. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
I know that you know you've impacted me, but I'm just so grateful to be able to share your message as a mom with all of our listeners. I mean, I'm going to try not to cry today, but I just am so inspired not only by your work and your impact, but that you're a mom living the life under pressure. And right as soon as you could come up for air, you started making change. I just think it's the coolest. It's just inspiring to me, you know?
Welcome to Talk Like a Mother Parenting Autism Podcast. We are Jen, Kim, Rachel, and Jamie. Take a seat at our table as we share with hope, humor, and honesty.
Thank you for listening to Talk Like a Mother Parenting Autism Podcast. For more of Series 23, Waving the White Flag. In our second episode, we are connecting with a new and dear friend of mine, Betsy Johnston. We're pleased to welcome Betsy, and we can't wait for you to hear what she has to say about breaking stigma and parenting under the pressures of, I guess, different. Hey, Betsy.
Hi, happy to be
Hey,
here.
girls. Thanks for coming. I first met Betsy in Edenton. This is like that Ferris Bueller line, my best friend's cousins, whatever. Betsy is a auntie to a friend of mine. No, let's see. A friend of mine's bestie, right?
That's right.
Something like that. Anyway, we exchanged a hug after I'd been following her for some time because Betsy is not only like one of those sweet, kind folks that you just feel an instant kinship with, but she also is one of the most fierce and loving advocates I've ever come across. Her life kind of took a turn when pretty significant mental illnesses kind of came into her play. And right as soon as they sort of hit stable, she started working with NAMI. And I'll let her tell you a little bit more about her story, but gosh, it's just so cool to be friends with someone who has been in 2017, got the Crisis Intervention Team Award of the Year. Is this right?
Yes. That was a big surprise. I was doing a lot of trainings in Eastern North Carolina, and we're a very rural area. And when I was nominated, I was told that this is the International Crisis Intervention Team Conference in Fort Lauderdale. And I was told by their leader that I was chosen because of the work we had done in a rural area. They were so happy to see something happening there. So it was a little bit of a fluke, but a great honor.
Well, I was looking for the name because I didn't want to get it wrong, but you were Advocate of the Year. And I just think that that's so incredible. Until I also read that you were given the Humanitarian Award in Edenton for also your impact there. I just think it's so great. For those of you that don't follow Betsy, I'll just say quickly that she has written a column called Dear Betsy for quite some time. And the impact that she's had across so many different disorders and sort of situations is just incredible. I recommend her book. But Betsy, do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Okay. My experience with specifically mental illness started in 1996. I was teaching music full-time in Washington, D.C. Our 13-year-old son had severe onset of bipolar disorder at age 13, and I'd never heard of that. I'd heard of manic depressive, but I had never heard of bipolar. And even with all the resources that were available in the Bethesda, we lived in Bethesda, you know, NIH, all of that, it was very hard to get a diagnosis at that time for someone in their preteens or in their teens, because, you know, they thought adolescence had a lot to do with it. But I can tell you he was self-mutilating, a very dangerous behavior, expelled from middle school for selling fake drugs. He was placed in a therapeutic lockdown school for 3 years. And then the miracles started happening with therapy in the school. And it took 4 more years to get the medication right, because we all know that medication with any kind of mental disorder or any other kind of developmental disorder and the things that all go together there, it's so much hit and miss, trial and error, trying to get medication straight. But anyway, we worked really hard. I can say I did. You know, my husband was kind of in denial, but he came on board later. But it was, we'll talk about stigma, because stigma had such a big, unfortunately, shadow over that period of time. And when he started to move into recovery, he mainstreamed after 3 years back to his high school, Maine High School. He graduated on time, and it goes on and on. But that's about the time when he started to move into recovery that I felt, God, a voice, however you want to think about it, telling me I needed to pay it forward. And NAMI, National Alliance on Mental Illness, the national headquarters was right across the river from me. So I contacted them and the national office, and they trained me to volunteer after work several days a week. They trained me to volunteer on the helpline, the national helpline. So for 7 years, a couple of afternoons a week, I took calls from all over the country. So that's where my first experience, lived experience, came from. Now, I had very little contact with lived experience where I was because of stigma. But these people were calling in from all over the country, and sometimes I could help them find resources, and sometimes there were no resources. But sometimes just to tell them the story of my son's progress, it gave them some light in their darkness.
Yeah.
And they would tell me that, thank you. Thank you for sharing that. And now I have some glimmer of hope. So that's where my advocacy started. And I'll just tell you that my son and my other son experienced mental illness a few years ago, a pretty severe period in his 30s. But the first son turned 40 in December. And he's been in recovery for 20 years. And it truly is. I mean, he's worked so hard. We've all worked so hard, but it really is a miracle that he
And
he
he's a dad and he's at
he's,
work.
Listen, he just turned 40. He's been in recovery for 20 years. He lives just outside Nashville, Tennessee. He has his own country music management company.
Wow.
He married a nurse. And they have two beautiful little children. He owns his own home. I mean, last summer they put a swimming pool in and had a birthday party for the daughter with mermaids. Wow. Such a great success story. And so my advocacy is just stronger than ever because, people need to have that hope that things can turn out. Maybe not always as well as they've turned out for my son, but there is hope. There is hope, and we need to share that with folks.
I was going to say, with people on the other end of the line that get you, I think that's comforting, like you said, just to hear your story, because they are so desperate for a lifeline of hope, really. So that's fantastic you're able to provide that for people.
Yeah, perfectly said. Absolutely.
For those of you who are fixing to buy Betsy's book and have not read it yet, it's called Dear Betsy, Letters from the Heart of Mental Illness. And so very much like her column, she organized these pieces by mental health disorder or by, sort of thing that she's accomplishing, explaining sort of the theme of these letters. Anyway, there's so much hope in each and every piece. There's often like the acknowledgement that there may or may not be resources in your area, that these are the things, sort of to look for, to look out for. And one of my favorite parts of your book, Betsy, is not just that you're writing these heartfelt responses based and rooted in education, but like filled with hope and love. You speak directly to everyone. Like you're talking about how to be a better friend. You're talking about how to connect with someone who's a caregiver. You're teaching everyone about language. And it's really incredible. It doesn't seem like there's a topic that you avoid. Given your book, it's like you hit every disorder, every sort of category of what the things are that affect families like ours.
Yeah.
And
I appreciate that.
That current of hope is huge.
Thank you.
When I met Betsy, our listeners know that I've struggled with suicidal ideation and depression. And when I met Betsy, that hug was so big because I was in such a dark place. And your book and really your page honors that you can be in the depths of it all and still find a glimmer of hope. And
I just had a Flannaville moment. It just clicked to me who Betsy is.
This is Dear Betsy, Jen.
Yeah, just had a Flannaville moment. Just had a moment. It just all clicked now. Welcome to the table. Yeah.
Betsy, my page is called Flannaville, as you know. My last name is Flanagan. And like 4 years into our best friendship, Jen Dunn goes, oh my God, that's your last name. So she just figured out that you're Betsy of Dear Betsy. That's good. That's good. Betsy, will you talk a little bit about stigma? That's one of my favorite chapters. You put it at the very front of your book because it's so important. I know that the stigma took away opportunities for your family and stood in between other people understanding. Can you speak a little bit about that impact?
Yes. I remember, you know, I was a teacher in a very prominent, it was a private, prominent school in DC. And I'd been there for quite a while. And my son, who had onset of bipolar disorder, was at the school when it was starting. And I was a pretty popular teacher. You know, I was the music teacher. I did musical theater. So we put on productions every year. So I just touched so many families in my work as a teacher. And I can tell you that when this happened, they all disappeared. You know,
yeah.
There was, I felt isolated. I felt shamed and blamed as a parent, as though something I or my husband and I had done that caused our son to have this awful behavior, because they, mm-hmm. all they saw was the behavior, and mm-hmm. they had no idea that he had a growing mental illness. And so it was very isolating. Mm-hmm. And confusing. I felt it not only from friends. I felt like friends who had children in the school my son's age and had been friends with him, that was all cut off. It was as though it was contagious.
Like overnight. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it was like if my child continues to have any contact with your child, then the same thing is going to happen. You know, this horrible experience. And I didn't really understand until my work with NAMI. And I can remember one night, maybe within a year after the diagnosis, and it was a tentative diagnosis, but someone had told me about NAMI. And y'all are too young to remember, but back in the 90s, there were desktop computers.
Girl, if you're going to talk about that big IBM, we were there. We were there.
Okay. Yes. These ginormous, you know, monitors up there. And I remember one night typing in NAMI.org, and it appeared. And there were descriptions about the different mental disorders and behavioral mm-hmm. disorders. And I remember, and what parents might go through, you know, with these different disorders.
How validating.
Yeah. And I remember shouting out loud, how did they know? How did they know? This was the first connection that I had, you know, and NAMI started with just a group of family members in 1979 around a kitchen table. And it grew into mm-hmm. this gigantic advocacy organization. And so, you know, that was a pivotal moment for me to feel like someone understood. And that's, you know, what I think is at the heart of stigma is that people do not understand. And they mm-hmm. many times say it touches so many different levels. They may be clueless, or they may choose actually to not understand. You know, they're yep. just so many levels. And, you know, we have public stigma, and the public stigma leads to internalized stigma. And, mm-hmm. you know, you as a caregiver or a parent internalize that stigma. Your child internalizes that stigma because, you know, of judgment or feelings of judgment, I guess, is yeah. the best word I can think of right now, not understanding. And that comes out in a lot of different ways. And then there's institutionalized stigma within school systems, within all kinds of institutions, as you go through this lived experience. I'm not sure if I'm answering what you're asking me,
right? No, that's exactly right. I feel like you go through that IBM moment, you know, when you looked up NAMI. I can almost see the glow of the screen on your, in like the dark nights of Googling or Ask Jeeves. I mean, I don't know what, but it's like, I could relate so much to that period, because finding out the things that we have about Seeley and then going to the pages or going to yes. any of our blog posts and just feeling so like, oh my God, me too. like, or thank goodness it's, we're not alone, you know, because when you're among your colleagues, there isn't another family just like yours. When you're in church, a community that used to be so comfortable, there isn't another family like yours. Like, and I think that when crisis hits, it just drives you in so tight where you buckle down the hatches, at least for families like ours, where being in public is too dangerous, you know, and it just compounds everything. But, you know, acknowledging that there's all these different facets to stigma and where it lives and how deep it goes. And man, it's not just one word. Like everything in our life, it's a spectrum.
Now, the network that you have created among so many mothers of children with autism is phenomenal. You know, I follow it. I follow Kate. I follow you, Rachel, and Carrie. I follow all of them, all of you. And I just think when I see you gather together, you know, a big group, it's so heartwarming. Phenomenal.
I feel like, you know, to your point earlier, the opposite of stigma or the end of stigma is understanding or whatever that, you know, phrasing would be. And for us, the end of isolation is just finding somebody that nods along with our same old shit life or what's going on that day or whatever, you know, because it just feels like it compounds. Can you talk to me a little bit about your language around saying mental illness versus mental health and kind of how you got there? Because you speak beautifully about it.
Well, I've always talked about mental illness. And when I decided to put together that book, my son and daughter-in-law, and as I said a little earlier, in his 30s, just a few years ago, he went through several years suicidal. It was a very dark period, and thankfully he's come out. He's in a very good place now. And I was visiting with them in D.C., when the book was in progress. And they said, well, you know, Mom, you're going to have to do a Facebook page. You know, you're going to have a page to market your book. And I said, absolutely not. I'm not going to do that. And I I'm too old. I don't want to do that. And I wouldn't do it just to sell a book. And then, you know, I came home and I kind of thought about it, prayed about it. And I decided, well, it could actually be a more interactive version of the newspaper column that I had done and became the book. And that has panned out. But in the beginning, that same son who, the marketer who said, you need to do your Betsy page, he said, well, Mom, instead of saying that you're advocating for mental illness, because I was slow to get followers, a page about mental illness. And he said, maybe you need to change it to advocating for mental health. And I actually went on and did a video about it and said,
yeah,
this is why I'm not going to change it to mental health.
Okay. I believe I saw that video.
That has been, you know, a little less than a year ago. And so right now, some folks in my community and I are getting ready to launch a series of sessions to educate the community. We're actually going to do it based in some of the local churches because this is a small town community and it's very faith-based. So I'm kind of coming full circle to saying, okay, maybe this will, whatever will invite more people in to raise awareness and to fight stigma because people don't want to talk about it. You know, they will call me, they will text me, they will private message me, all these local people and tell me all these crises that they're going through, but they won't share it with their general community. So we're putting together something that will start in September. And we're thinking of calling the big title something like the Mental Health Connection. And, you know, even a month ago, that would go against every grain in my body to do that. But we have to think about
if the greater good. If it feels like arms open, it's worth what will bring the people in, right?
We can have a subtitle that will have mental illness in it, you know, and make it clear when we advertise it that we're going to be educating and offering resources for mental illness. But maybe the big title might be something like the Mental Health Connection. And I can't even believe I'm saying that. But we have to adjust in advocacy and think about the greater good, you know, not just what I think. I can be a very
I did not mean to call you out on your on your 28-day-old
I can be a really self-righteous person, and I'm stubborn. I'm so stubborn. But sometimes, you know, you just have to open up and say, okay, what's going to reach the most people and bring the most awareness? So we'll see. We haven't had, I have representatives that are going to be on the steering committee, and we haven't had our, I know who they are, but we haven't had our first meeting yet. And that will be a subject to talk about.
I think that people perceive mental illness as like something negative, like almost like there's something wrong with them. Where mental health, I feel like, is like everybody has mental health, whether you have a mental health disorder, mental health struggles, great mental health. Like, it's such like a softer way, I think, of saying it. And I think that's what happens. And that's where the stigmas come from, because it's like, we have the same thing where like with autism, like people will be like, oh, it's not a disorder. I mean, it's classified as a disorder, but like, they'll be like, it's not a disorder, because it's like, it's the same thing. They don't want to like be associated with a disorder, because that like implies something wrong, you know, something wrong with your brain or like whatever. So it's like, I feel like people just kind of like shy away from that, because it's, I don't know, maybe harder to accept that or even like say that about yourself or a loved one, because it's like, it is other people's reaction, even if it's technically what it's classified as. I think, yeah, I feel like they're always trying to find softer ways of like describing things, you know, as we go with the autism, like things just constantly get changed, like the terms
we
that they
started.
Use
When we started the podcast, Betsy, we talked about this a little earlier. We were Table for Five, No Reservations podcast. And we specifically did not mention autism in it because we didn't want to be.
Oh, really?
We didn't want to be just one thing. We wanted to be able to discuss all the stuff. But it turns out that autism affects every layer and level of our lives. And it's also the connection between the four of us. And so as we rebranded, we really tried to identify like what we're doing. So Talk Like a Mother, because we're still keeping it real. But parenting autism really is in every facet of it. And so it's been funny for us to like flip on this idea too, to be able to lean in, to get folks to find us, to, you know, because you can't make an impact when people aren't showing up to your meeting. It's just real.
Right. Yeah. Same with the Facebook page, right?
Right. Yep.
And I find with that, for example, today I did a modification of...
I knew I recognized it.
That stigma. And that's from my book. But, you know, you have to make it a little more palatable for Facebook, for, you know, attention span. And, you know, I'm not saying that in a bad way, but people are... you know, time driven when they're on Facebook. And so today I put something pretty lengthy up about stigma, getting ready for tonight. And now tomorrow will be something a little lighter, you know, because you have to keep people drawn in. You know, if I did that, and I learned that along the way, if I put too much heavy stuff on my Facebook page day after day, you know, I'm not going to get
in the information. That's what I love about your book and really your articles and the way that you've sort of picked paper to do your work, because you're not writing a textbook, but you're giving all of this really clinical information and also really important lived experience, but you're doing it almost like it's a letter to the reader or a letter to the person who's asking. And there's just so much soul in that. I don't know. I think it's cool. Can I read a little bit about a caregiver piece of yours from here?
Sure.
Would you rather I read terribly your words, or would you rather read your book? I don't know what just left awkward for you. Okay. Well, wish me luck. Okay. So in this is on page 80 for when you guys get your copies at home. It says, well, I just can't help it. Everybody should own this. You know, I bought extra. So in this chapter, Betsy's talking about caregiving and PTSD, which is something we've talked a lot about in the last few series. The writer says, "Dear Betsy, I have a family member who is the sole caretaker for her mother until she entered a nursing home about a year ago. She had such a hard time this past year dealing with the guilt of relinquishing her mother's care to others, showing signs of residual stress. Do you have any information that might help me and others in understanding what she's experiencing?" And while we don't, we're not trying to talk about the, you know, Alzheimer's transition for this person, I feel like what you wrote about caregiving and PTSD is profound for our listeners. You write, "Dear Cracks," because they said cracks in the exterior, P.S. Not that you just call your people cracks. "Dear Cracks,
You're Thank you for that clarification.
Yes. Deer crap, people. Your loved one may be suffering from a form of PTSD. Post-traumatic stress disorder is brought on by witnessing or experiencing a terrifying event. Although this is most commonly tied to war veterans, anyone who has suffered trauma is at risk of developing PTSD. Can caregiving cause PTSD? For many people, the answer is yes. Caregiving is not only physically exhausting, but emotionally and mentally draining as well. This is especially true for adult children who take care of parents with dementia or a severe disability, which also that kind of made me a little misty, that little or severe disability. Many caregivers feel an extreme amount of pressure and responsibility to provide care for their loved ones, but at the same time feel powerless to stop the debilitating condition. The stress remains long after the caregiving ends. Here are some symptoms. And you go on to talk about anxiety and sleeplessness, reliving the experience. And for many of us, it's not something that ends. It's continually compounding. You talk about the physical pain and the mental anguish, like those aches and pains that are just unrelenting and don't help with the Advil. And then you talk finally about antisocial behavior before you go on to discuss how to help that friend. And I just think for the listeners that have not yet followed your page or bought your book yet, it's like that in every letter, that you sort of describe the nuts and bolts of something, you validate the person who has, you know, poured their heart out, and then you give like really brief takeaways that are just so actionable. Is there anything that you didn't write in about caregiving in this book that, or what I read, that you'd like to add?
Well, you know, some of that came from my own family. We have a lot of Alzheimer's in my family. In my grandmother's generation, she and three of her siblings died of Alzheimer's. And my father's sister had died with Alzheimer's. And my cousin that I grew up with here was her primary caregiver. And he has not recovered, you know, and he's not in a very good way right now. But a few years ago, I sat down with him when I think right before his mom passed and talked to him about the caregiving. And he gave me a lot of insights. I'm not sure he could give me those same insights right now, but it was pretty fresh. Then with Alzheimer's, there's the sundowning, you know, in the evening, and the symptoms are so much worse. And he helped me understand some of that. And these letters, Rachel and the rest of you, they came from a column that I wrote in our local newspaper, because we had a support group here, that it was a NAMI support group. And unfortunately, not many people came to the support group because of stigma.
Yeah.
What will people think if I'm going to a meeting for crazy people? I mean, really, that's how people think, especially in a small town. So one night we were sitting around and we were thinking about what could we do if we can't get people to come here? How can we get information about mental illness out to the community? And I said, well, I know the editor of the local newspaper, and maybe I could write a few articles. And one of the members of the support group said, he joked and said, well, maybe you could do a Dear Abby sort of thing. And we all laughed. We thought, oh, that's funny. And when I was driving home, I couldn't shake the idea. And so I ran it by the editor of the local newspaper, and he ran with it. And so I just used the stories that I had heard on that national helpline, other from the support group I was running, to provide the fodder, you know, to provide the so-called questions, you know, I called it Dear NAMI at first. So it would say Dear NAMI, and just like the letter that Rachel was reading. And then a new editor came to town and he said, you have to put your picture and your name on it or it's gone. And we argued and argued and he won. And it turned out to be the best thing, because I'm not kidding you. Everywhere I went, people would stop me because of the picture, not because of my name, but because of the picture. And they would say, I'd be in the bank, I'd be in the grocery store, I'd be at the fish market. And they would say, are you the one that writes that column? And I'd say, maybe. And then they would just start to share their story. Yeah, they would start to share their story just right there, wherever we were. And so their story that they shared with me in person became the Dear Betsy or the Dear Nami letter. You know, I would put it in the form of a Dear Abby kind of thing. And people used to tell me that they would cut these newspaper columns out and keep them just in case, you know.
Just in case, so, I love that.
Just in case, you know, and I would get calls. I would get calls all the time to say, I have a neighbor or so-and-so. Mm-hmm. I was at the newspaper one time talking about the next column, and the reporter there said, Betsy, could you go stop by the little bookstore down the street? Because my friend there, I'm really worried about her. I've seen some things on Facebook, and I think some things. She was suicidal. I've stopped by. I've never met her before. And I stopped. That's what the kind of thing that was happening. Mm-hmm. And it was opening doors, and it was raising awareness. And then COVID hit, you know, and that's mm-hmm. when I decided
and then everything
to put the column into a book was during COVID, because everything shut down, and support groups and all of that shut down. And fortunately, you know, now there's so much virtual, like we're virtual
yeah.
right now.
Yeah.
And so yeah. that's a good thing. Good thing.
I think that's so cool how, I mean, even though he made you put your picture on there, you didn't want to, but how that kind of broke the stigma by you putting yourself out there. And I'm sure that was a lot to take on. I know just from us all sharing our blogs and stuff, a lot of people write into us and tell us their stories, and it can be a lot to take that on for other people. So I think that's beautiful that you were willing to do that for people and talk to people and put your image on that, and in such a small community where people weren't talking about it.
Yeah. Yeah. I have quite a reputation now. Sometimes my family just shakes their head, you know.
Like, we just want to walk around. We don't want people to come talk to you.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
Therapy with Betsy, no copay. Just when you leave. Betsy, what is there anything that when I invited you, is there anything that you thought that you'd want to tell our listeners that we've not talked about tonight?
Well, I think it's so important when you look at stigma. And there's stigma with developmental disorders, with mental illness, cancer. There's still stigma with cancer in a small mm-hmm. community like ours. It's not like it was before. But when you're talking about stigma, you need to think about examples of stigma. So there's language, you know, when people... That's the biggest thing that, and I have to catch myself, you know, sometimes mm-hmm. using the word crazy, you know, I've tried to help myself with that, but psycho crazy, talking about demons, people struggling with demons. I would imagine there are some people that might associate that with autism, mm-hmm. you know, that they think, oh gosh, you know, what does that child have inside of him or her that's causing that, maybe an episodic outburst or something like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, the language that we use, and also how people tend to define people by their disorder or their illness. And that's such a no-no. You know, we need to see people first. We need to be very specific. Even to say Celie is autistic, that might be acceptable, but better maybe to say she lives with autism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Instead of just saying that autistic girl.
You know, right. Yeah. You know. We talk about first language a lot in our, in all these different settings, because it's very easy for somebody to look at Celie's file outside of the clinic or outside of the room or therapy session and make some decisions about her and come in just looking at that autistic girl, when really there's so much more going on, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then there are the actions that come from stigma, and feeling cut off, feeling isolated by mm-hmm. your community, mm-hmm. by your people. There is a reluctance to talk about it. That's an action, you know, or an inaction, mm-hmm. I guess, that people are very reluctant. I don't want to talk about autism. You know, I don't want to talk about bipolar disorder. Those are scary things to some people. And we need to make them less scary. And you do that by educating, you know, and that's what you all are doing here. And what I'm trying to do is to educate people. I always like to say, in terms of that isolation that comes from stigma, where was the casserole? When somebody's going through a physical illness, cancer, or some other terrible illness that happens, it has to have surgery, there's a meal train. At least where I live, people set up a meal train and their phone calls. And with something like mental illness, and I don't know if it's your experience when you're going through a particularly difficult time, either with yourself or, you know, with your child, where's the casserole? You know, why isn't somebody reaching out and supporting you when you really need it? And so, you know, there are the results of all of this is that you don't share. In many cases, you don't share what you're going through. Or if you're living with a mental disorder, I know so many people in my little community who live with something called smiling depression. I don't know if you've all heard of smiling depression, but there are a lot of people in our little community that have told me that they're prominent people in the community. They have families, they have successful careers, and they don't share. And sometimes they don't seek help with their depression because they're worried about how people will judge them. They worry about
keep the mask on.
They keep the mask on, and they tell. I have had more than one person in our community tell me that they wake up every single day and wonder how they're going to get through the day and not kill themselves. Mm-hmm. Nobody knows because they're wearing a smile. For children, there's bullying. There's harassment, shame, I think. And maybe they don't call it shame, but maybe they're feeling embarrassed sometimes. But all of these things are the result. And the worst thing that can happen, again, is suicide, you know, for someone who has felt so stigmatized that they can't reach out and they feel so isolated. And again, that's happened in our little community. I was so impressed that at a church service I attended a few weeks ago, it wasn't the priest, it was a deacon in the Catholic Church. And he preached about suicide.
Oh my goodness.
He preached about mental illness, but then he touched on suicide. And he talked about someone in our community who had the smile, and people didn't reach out enough to know that she was suffering and that she killed herself. And he didn't mince any words. And I went, whoa, I'm just so that's glad you're talking
evolution.
About,
yeah.
You know,
I mean, that's he amazing. Was probably going through seminary when, or whatever the appropriate language would be, when there was a view that you go to hell about it. I mean, progressive to just understand more and to spread that message. It's incredible. Yes,
I thought it was incredible. So, you know, we just need to educate. And that's a lot of what I'm sure you all are doing. You're sharing and you're educating, and that raises awareness.
I'll tell you, Betsy, one of the things that linked us and so many of the guests that have come on are writers. It is so therapeutic to process our feelings through the pen or the keyboard or, you know, the thumbs on the phone to sort of process and to put that in order so that we can make sense of it to relay. It's been incredible. And I feel like probably writing your column has likely given you some closure in areas that you didn't know you needed, because you just get to process in such a concise way to give a message, you know?
Yeah.
Sharing has changed everything. It's not only brought us to each other, but it's also helped these other people find themselves in us and message us and sort of stay connected to the hope that we show. I mean, it's just so freeing. Get out of your own way.
There's so much power, I think, in understanding and realizing that you're not alone in your situation. Because some situations that we face, whether it's with mental illness, with autism, caregiving, whatever it is, like sometimes there's nothing you can do. There's nothing anyone can say. There's no advice. It's just, you're just living in this really rough patch at the time. But to know that like somebody else truly understands how hard it is and truly understands, you know, how heartbreaking it is, or whatever it is that you're feeling or going through. I mean, I think there's such power in that, because in these situations, sometimes there's nothing someone can say. And I think that's what happens to people and why, I don't know if it's so much a stigma, but people just get very uncomfortable because they don't know how to react. They don't know what to say to you. They don't know.
There isn't like a get better. I hope they get better.
They just don't know the appropriate responses. And sometimes there's not an appropriate response. Like, it's just, you know, so I think that happens a lot with people where they just don't know what to say. So then they just kind of shy away from the situation and just kind of like distance themselves from you, you know, which is obviously not the right thing to do, because then that just makes the people feel more isolated and alone and all that. But I've seen that happen a lot. My daughter's 27. So when she was first diagnosed, it wasn't as much of a known thing, you know, as it is now. Now everybody knows what autism is, but it's like, you know, people just can see, it's like, they just don't know, or, you know, or they'll ask like all these crazy questions and you're like, always happy to answer questions. But like, sometimes they're just like, you know, not the questions you're prepared to answer at the time when you're, you know, when you're really going through the heart of it. But I really do think there's just so much power in like really just feeling like you're not the only one going through it.
I so agree, Kim.
A lot of people just don't want to be uncomfortable, or they don't want to think outside their little world or their little bubble. They feel like it takes too much from them to like, oh, they would rather just see like our children as misbehaving, like you were talking about in the beginning, than really looking deeper, because that takes time and education and understanding to look deeper. And so I agree with Kim too, but I think it's like, also there's safety, I think, in ignorance for a lot of people, and they would rather stay that way. And sometimes a lot of cruelness and hate can come from that, which is a big bummer.
Absolutely. Absolutely. One thing that I tell people, I try to communicate as much as I can, is that you don't have to have the right thing to say. Just reaching out to someone that you know something's going on and just saying, want to get a cup of coffee, want to just sit, you know. And I guess people, they're so anxious to, as you said, Kim, want to say something, and yet so they're not comfortable all the time with saying nothing. And sometimes when you're struggling, you just need to know somebody's there. You just need to know that there's someone who cares. And I just say over and over, you don't have to know the right things to say. When I've been with people in crisis, I've just sat with them, you know.
It's so much more about listening silent, too.
You know,
yeah, but that's what people
every
need.
Now and then. Right. Every now and then saying, you know, is there something that you want to share, or, you know, is there anyone I can call for you? Just to be there, you know, let's, as you said, Kim, let's people know that they're not alone. That's the main thing. Feeling alone is terrible.
I feel like even a text of someone saying, oh, thinking of you, because sometimes it's a lot to take on, you know, especially when with mental health stuff. Like, I have a sister who has a lot of mental health struggles. So it's like, sometimes I take on her stuff, which is very hard, you know, that's very hard, because then it's like, you know, so sometimes it's like, if you feel like you can't do that, you can even just send a text, just let someone know that you're thinking of them. Like, you know, even though that's just such a small thing, in certain times that does make you feel just less alone, you know.
A lot of people have asked me, since I shared so openly about my suicidal struggle, like, what should I do, or what am I supposed to do? And I feel like so often it's just a touch point and listening. Because if I have, I mean, I don't care what the touch point is. It could be coffee. It could be a Zoom. It could just be a quickie visit. It could be no visit at all, because don't come to my door, I'm falling apart. But just listening and reaching, like just reaching out. It's something, how impactful it can be in a moment of need, you know. Betsy, one of our new things that we've been doing is something called One Last Thing. And that's where we round the table and just discuss one last point before we finish up. I have one last thing. This week I got a call from the Department of Education. Basically, this person told me that they don't handle complaints like that. To which I said, complaints like what? What happened? I learned basically that something happened while my daughter was in care, and nobody can tell us anything. And like, the protection of a process, just because you have to protect the process, is such bullshit to me, that we have to like hide behind all of this, like, who handles what and who can say what within reporting. It's just a crock. I feel, in my one last thing, I just wish for more transparency. I just wish people could call a spade, that we could say we're struggling when we're struggling, that you could own it, that you could connect with a parent that's open and say, this is what happened to me. Anyway, I'm over it. I'm freaking over it. That's my one last thing. Anybody else?
I want to thank some guy named George. We have to go through a specialty pharmacy for my daughter's med, and our regular guy, who's very nice and made me feel very comfortable, apparently didn't do a lot of the work he needed for us to do to get a med that we need for a procedure next week. And some guy, I just want to thank some random guy named George who came through for me on the phone and took care of everything for me. I know that's really random, but this stuff
is George.
Calling like therapy places all the time and med places, pharmacies, dealing with doctors and stuff. Sometimes it's just nice to have a nice person. So thank you to all the people who work in those places and are just nice and understanding, because it's, we're sometimes panicking and it's nice to have someone that's just like, I'll take care of it. Shout out to George.
Well, I didn't have George, but I had a Mike. So my last, that just reminds me, I have a disability tax accountant. All he does is disability stuff. And I thought Kaya had a lifetime designation. Apparently she didn't, and it expired. And so I was just like, are you kidding me? This is one more thing. Seriously, her autism doesn't go away. And I've never experienced having to literally submit paperwork again to show my kid's still autistic. And so anyway, I was just thanking him because he's like, I'll take care of all the paperwork. Just send me this one form. And anyway, so thanks, Mike.
I have a positive and a negative. So on the positive side, for those of you who have been following along, know that Alyssa has a really hard time every time her sister comes home from college. So this week is spring break. My daughter compartmentalizes. So like in her mind, she does not belong here. Even though this is, her, she still lives here, even though she's away at college. My daughter doesn't see it that way. In her mind, she's gone. She doesn't belong here. So when she comes back, it's very hard for her to readjust. This time, Kara walked in the door. Alyssa goes, aw, and put her arms out. Like, that's like her little way of saying, I love you. But then immediately started screaming, I love you, but I don't want you here. But we only had one night of her having a really hard time. And the next day, it was done. In the past, that's this amazing. Has gone on for four days. On the flip side of what's not great is Alyssa got back into Lexi's room and she crossed out her whole March calendar, X'd out every square after Lexi put all her assignments and all her things in for the whole month. So yeah, she was not happy about that.
You win
and
some, you lose some.
Then I wrote on the top of the calendar, I wrote, I love you, Lexi, and did a heart. And then the next day, Lexi came home and that was also crossed off. The whole thing was just like blacked out. So she was not a fan. I think she's gonna actually get a lock for her door and we'll see what happens. That'll be another one last thing for another week, I'm sure.
Betsy, do you have one last thing?
Just in the last 2 weeks, because as I said, we're trying to start this new initiative here. And so, you know, I've met with pastors and I've met that I didn't know before, and other people that are helping, you know, with the steering committee. And so I've had an opportunity to share part of my journey. You know, a lot. I spoke to the Lions Club a week ago. You know, they help people with their vision, and they were so receptive, and they bought some of my books. It was an amazing night, and so here I am tonight, and I was so nervous. I had no idea what to expect. I've never been part of a podcast before, and it's been such a blessing again. You know, to share some of my story and to hear your part of your journeys. And, you know, I just, I feel very blessed and very, very happy to be here tonight.
Well, thank you so much.
It's nice to meet you.
I can't wait for everybody to fall even deeper in love with you through your work. Dear Betsy is available where? Where can the people find you? Like, how does it go?
DearBetsy.org. I have a website. DearBetsy.org.
That's where you can find the book. That's incredible. It's around $20. It's probably like 28 shipped. I don't know. And then you can
go
to
free shipping. I do free shipping there.
Oh my God. What a woman. Let's see, on Facebook, Dear Betsy, but you don't Instagram, do you?
No, I don't. My kids me tell either. Me I should. I yeah. only follow
and don't
my
call
kids
it the Instagram. Instagram. All right. Well, everybody, we will see you for episode 3. I can't wait to talk more like a mother.
Bye.
You guys
bye.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Talk Like a Mother Parenting Autism podcast. If you are enjoying our podcast, make sure to rate and review us wherever you listen. And if you'd like to support us, you can become a subscriber. Just check out the description of this episode. Give us a follow on Facebook and Instagram for more content, and we'll see you next time.